does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it all.
Halfway through the 1 o'clock hour on a Monday of Query & Company. How are you? My name is Jake Query. Jimmy Cook, the other voice you hear on this program. Eddie Garrison flying the controls for us. Busy sports day today, and the NBA is the epicenter of a lot of that. Evan Sidery covers the NBA for Forbes, also for Athlon, Sporting News, a number of different areas. You hear him on this radio station frequently discussing the association. And Evan, I will begin right with this. Do you anticipate that between now and the end of this opening round series between the Pacers and Milwaukee, whether that be one more game, whether it be, you know, three more, whatever it might be, do you think we again see Giannis or Damian Lillard playing?
Oh, that's a good question. I'd appreciate the invite today. I will say that I'm going to lean no. I think the Pacers closes out Tuesday in Milwaukee. I don't think we see Lillard or Giannis play. But if the Bucks, let's say they do win Game 5, I would not be shocked at all if Lillard tried to play in Game 6. At this point, I'm kind of ruling out Giannis and Tyler entirely. It just seems like the Bucks, they're kind of getting all indications there that Giannis isn't close to his recovery so far. He's really going slow in teamwork so far. He hasn't really gotten on the court much in 5-on-5. So I doubt at this point, if we see Giannis at all, I think it's going to be at all in this series.
Evan, how do you properly evaluate how the Pacers have performed in the playoffs when accounting for what Milwaukee has gone through? Because my argument's always been, once you get to the postseason, if Lady Luck's going to smile on you, an injury is going to go the other way, or, you know, players going to lose their cool like Portis did last night, you know, that's not your fault. You take advantage of what's there. How do you properly evaluate where the Pacers have performed well and how you can prognosticate where they go moving forward in the playoffs, given what Milwaukee's dealt with?
Yeah, I think if Giannis, of course, would have played in this series, Jimmy, I think maybe Milwaukee has this thing tied up instead of being 3-1. But Indiana has been fantastic so far this series. Outside of that first game when they really got ran off the court there, Rick Carlisle made some great adjustments. They ran it through Pascal Siakam in those first couple games. They made another counter adjustment with now they're focusing on Pascal Siakam. See Miles Turner having big games and back-to-back games. Tyrese Halliburton bouncing back in big form as well. It just kind of how the cookie crumbles, in my opinion. It reminds me a lot of people were criticizing the Phoenix Suns back in 2020 when they went on their finals run, when they faced a lot of teams that were missing stars in the way there. But it's just kind of how it is. And if the Pacers had a matchup with a Giannis-less Milwaukee Bucks team, you got to take advantage of that. And that's exactly what they're doing. But I think even with Giannis playing in this series, the way the Pacers have been playing, the way Miles Turner's been playing, Pascal Siakam for sure, I think it's still a very competitive, tough series. It might go 6 or 7 if Giannis would have played.
You know, and I'm not certain, Evan, I hope I'm wrong here for the sake of Indiana and their fans, but to me, it's really big. You got to close it out now, right? Because you don't want them hanging around, because I will give Milwaukee credit. I mean, at the very least, this is a team and a franchise that has a championship pedigree, right? So with that, you're not going to fold up 10, right? I mean, they're not, right? I mean, tell me I'm wrong there.
No, they're gonna go and give it a very valiant effort Tuesday, I imagine. Even if they're missing Lillard and Giannis, we know Bobby Portis is going to be back in that lineup after the ejection. He's going to go out and make it a little nasty.
Could he be suspended, by the way?
I doubt it. I doubt it, honestly. It was kind of that playoff kind of skirmish with him and Nembhard there.
But there's not a rule that says that if he threw a punch that he has to miss the next game, right?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, if he attempted it and it landed, I mean, obviously he would have missed. But I mean, it didn't seem that bad, at least to me last night, as far as how it was. Obviously, it was very rowdy and amped up in there. And it was a really cool moment, too, to see how the Pacers fans reacted to that. But yeah, I doubt that Portis is going to miss any time, if any.
If you simulate this thing forward and we end up getting what looks like the clear favorite of happening, which is Hicks-Knicks, Pacers-Knicks once again, what have you seen from both? I know you've touched on it already with the Pacers. What have you seen from both those clubs, particular this year? And what about the idea of a, you know, Andrew Nembhard, Jalen Brunson type of matchup do you like about everything from the post play, where the Pacers have the edge, where the Knicks have the edge? What do you make of that potential series?
Yeah, that's going to be a really fun one, and one where I think it's kind of too close to call still, in my opinion. I know a lot of national people are going to say the Knicks are going to win that series in 5 or 6, but I think the Pacers actually match up very well against this Knicks team, especially with no Julius Randle, who's out for the season with a shoulder injury. It's going to really all come down to guarding Jalen Brunson, not letting him get to the rim much, and also guarding the shooters, mainly Dante DiVincenzo. I think Pacers fans know when they face him this year, Dante DiVincenzo's gone off a lot in those games for three-point range. He can flip a couple games on his own head if he wants to. But I think the main thing with guarding Jalen Brunson, he's averaging 28 drives to the basket per game in his series against Philadelphia. That's almost every time he touches the ball, he's going towards the rim. It's how are you going to stop Jalen Brunson from getting to the foul line, getting to the rim, and getting those easy shots? And that's going to be a lot on Andrew Nembhard, a lot on Aaron Nesmith. It's going to be a lot of pressure on them. But as far as offense against the Knicks defense, I actually really like their matchup there. I think they can outpace them. I know it's a very tough, gritty team Tom Thibodeau has in that end, but I don't really see a lot of issues there. I know OG Anunoby is an elite defender, and he might go up against Pascal Siakam potentially, but I think this is a series where you might see Tyrese Haliburton go off. If he's fully healthy, I know he tweaked his back a little bit last night. I imagine he does play on Tuesday. I think that's a series to me where Tyrese Haliburton is fully motivated, that Wally Szczerbiak thing, he holds that still in his head about he's not an all-star level player. I think it's going to be a really, really fun match between Brunson and Tyrese Haliburton. Really, it's going to come down, in my opinion, to which superstar point guard is the best one. But if we're going to see that series, and I imagine we will, I'm actually going to probably lean towards the Pacers in 6 or 7. I just think they have more talent, and the injury of Julius Randle is a 20-point, 10-rebound kind of player. I think it's going to loom large the deeper they get in the postseason.
Evan Sidery is our guest talking about the NBA, Pacers and Milwaukee now at 3-1, Indiana leading. Evan, I mentioned this earlier. I wanted you to elaborate on it because you probably also have a better – well, you do have a better perspective from a national standpoint of what people would opine on this. Myles Turner's been a common and popular kind of whooping dog for Pacer fans over the years. And I just felt like Indiana was very dedicated towards getting players that they thought could feed off of the things that Turner brings to the table, which would be rim protection, facilitating transition, and then – back end threes coming down the floor, and they've been patient with that. What's the outside perception of Myles Turner, and does this city owe him an apology?
Yeah, I think a lot of fans do, Jake. And I would say nationally, he's probably viewed as a top 50 player. He's one of the more highly renowned rim protectors nationally. He's a really a great modern day big. If you're looking for a team nowadays, you want to build the modern day center in 2024. A lot of it's going to revolve around Myles Turner. You need to shoot the three-pointer at a 35-40% clip. You need to be a great rim protector. You need to be able to switch as well. You need to be able to score on multiple levels. And Myles Turner's really fully developed into that, and that's kudos to him and his development. But also, I think that Tyrese Haliburton trade, when he arrived a couple years ago, Jake, that really changed everything for him because he had never had a table-setting point guard like that in his career. He was playing out of position with Domantas Sabonis. Then you have Haliburton arrive. He's playing a lot to five, pick and roll, trailing on threes. It's kind of just a perfect fit for what Myles Turner needed in his career to finally get that moment where he could be kind of show he could be an 18 to 20 point per game scorer. And now on the biggest stage, he's averaging almost 25 points per game on 40% 3-point shooting, plus his great defense. I mean, it's just kudos to Myles Turner and his development. And I think really, like you mentioned, Jake, he's a guy that's been traded with for 4 or 5 years, but now I believe he's extension eligible this summer. I would not be shocked at all if the Pacers gave him another contract because he deserved one.
NBA national writer Evan Sidery is our guest. You can find his work all over, including at the Sporting News as well as from Forbes Sports. Evan, I know you also have done a good job covering the developments in Phoenix. Jake and I talked about this earlier in the show, where perhaps the Suns are a cautionary tale for when you gut a system, gut a roster that got you to an NBA Finals appearance, and you throw a bunch of stars together that it doesn't always work out. There's been a mixed bag of teams trying to replicate what the Celtics had in 08, what the Heat had in 2011, of throwing together three guys and hoping that it all works. It did not for Phoenix. In your boat, where did it go wrong? Where can they fix it, if at all, with the no-trade clause with Beal and the other mess that they have? And is it a cautionary tale to teams that, hey, if you have good depth, maybe you shouldn't rush?
Yeah, certainly. I think a lot of people nationally are kind of realizing just how bad the Suns team was this year, just how inconsistent they were. It seemed like the energy was never there. The chemistry was definitely not there. It just seemed like Durant and Booker and Beal didn't really appear like they liked each other that much, which is not really a good thing if you want your three-star players on that roster making over almost $200 million over the next 4 or 5 years. But I think for them, it really is a cautionary tale because you get Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson, two young pieces that fit well with Devin Booker. You get DeAndre Ayton for a slower center and Yusuf Nurkic. Of course, you got Kevin Durant in the process. Of course, you got Bradley Beal. But you need to know in this new CBA where you're going to be so restricted as far as assets go. The Suns have two tradable draft picks over the next 8 years. That is incredible, just the way they've gone about putting all their chips in the middle of the table. They have no flexibility now. And they're kind of at a position where, in my opinion, if they want to get out of this, I don't see how they can improve that team with how little assets they have. They're going to have to see if they maybe let Kevin Durant or Devin Booker get traded this summer. I would not be shocked that's on the table at all because I don't know how they get out of that. They're going to have to run it back next year. If so, maybe you fire the head coach of Frank Vogel, but really, what's that going to do in the end for that roster? So I think it really is truly, if you have a young core like the Pacers have, for example, and let's say down the road a superstar becomes available, do you really want to give Benedict Mathurin or Andrew Nembhard, Aaron Nesmith, those kind of guys, and multiple draft picks on top of that and make a run? Because this core the Pacers have, they're all under 25 years old. You have at least two or three more years with a lot of these guys in this core together before it gets super expensive. I think that this is a team where you just let it ride out and see what happens. Because if the golden opportunity arrives down the road where a star becomes available and he wants to play with Tyrese Haliburton, of course you explore that. But it really is a cautionary tale now because Phoenix really is turning a lot of heads in that aspect.
Evan, in terms of teams in the East, and I guess you can include those that didn't make the playoffs if you chose, but in terms of the teams in the East right now, if you look at, and I know this is kind of ridiculous when the Pacers are a win away from advancing in the playoffs for, you know, and they've won a playoff game for the first time in 6 years. But if you look 2 years down the road, which team in the East is best set up for this to not be flash in the pan, but rather long-term sustained success?
That's a really good question. And this might be sort of a cop-out answer with the way they're constructed right now. And I would say Boston, of course. I don't think Boston's going anywhere the next 2 or 3 years with Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. They locked up Porzingis. They locked in Jrue Holiday, too. That core is not going anywhere. So Boston's going to be at the top of the conference for a long time. Milwaukee, I think, is one that's really interesting to me because I don't know if Giannis or Lowe's going to be there the next couple of years. And that could really open up a lot for the Pacers there. And that gets me to the discussion of, outside of Boston, maybe Indiana's up in that top three as far as brightest pieces in the Eastern Conference. With Haliburton, you have Siakam, you'd imagine, locked up after this summer long-term. You have all these good young pieces. Maybe you could throw New York into that mix with Brunson and all their young guys and their assets, what they do this summer. But I would say Indiana's definitely in that top three or top four. And looking back a year ago at this time, there was no way you would have expected that. And that just is a real cool thing for Indiana where they're one game away from the second round, but also long-term, you look ahead a little bit. There's so many good young core pieces of the puzzle, so many good fits that fit well together that I don't see why this Indiana team can't improve and be even better the next couple of years.
How about Orlando? I do think Banchero is very, very good, but they have really intriguing young wing pieces, but I have no idea what, say, their contractual status is.
Yeah, so that's a good one. I honestly forgot about Paolo and Franz Wagner. That's a really good 1-2 young core there. They also have $60-plus million in cap space this summer if they want to make any moves there. But with a lot of small markets, obviously Indiana is the same thing where, will a star player really want to go to Orlando? And that's going to be what Magic are going to have to hope for down the road. But Paolo Banchero is a top 25 player in this league when he's fully healthy. He's shown it this year. Franz Wagner, I think, is in the top 40 range. So I think Orlando's right there, to be honest. But I think Tyrese Haliburton, if he's fully healthy and he plays the way we saw in the first couple months of the season, that 24-point-per-game, 12-assist player, I think he trumps a lot of players in this conference. I think we see a fully healthy Tyrese Haliburton again alongside this roster. I would honestly lean Indiana more than Orlando.
For Pacers fans that are also NBA fans, Evan Sidery, national NBA writer, is our guest. I know the Joker would likely want a word on this part, Evan, but is Anthony Edwards the single greatest show out West?
Yeah, I mean, as far as entertainment value goes, I have no arguments with that one, Jimmy. I think the way he's played, it's been honestly incredible to watch. He's taken over that Minnesota team by the horns. Rudy Gobert, Karl Anthony Towns, they're really the second and third options now as far as this is Anthony Edwards' team, and he's establishing he's one of the best players in the NBA. He took over that entire series against Phoenix, swept them, as we saw last night, with a 40-point game. I think we're really close now. We'll have to see how it goes next year between Minnesota and Denver. But let's say Minnesota beats Denver next round and Nikola Jokic goes out. I think there's going to be a lot of noise by Anthony Edwards being a top five, top three player in the league if it hasn't already happened. And I think for Minnesota, you have a guy that's 22, 23 years old. That's not even close to his prime yet. I mean, that's the golden goose situation for an NBA organization to have, where you have a young wing player, 30-point-per-game scorer. You have all these guys around him that are locked up long-term. Minnesota's a team to me where I think they have a real chance of making the finals this year, the way they're playing. And then Anthony Edwards is really showing he is a top five, top three player, and definitely, I'd say, the most entertaining one out west.
And Jake, you still got the local tie, too, because Mike Conley has been so critical for them throughout this entire, like, 4 or 5 year stretch, but especially here in the playoffs.
I mean,
also,
just a steady pro, right?
Yep.
Anthony Edwards, though, listen, guys, to me, this guy is the closest that I've seen. And I know that people talk about, like, and hear me out, okay?
All right.
I'm not talking about necessarily, like, at this point in terms of skill set, touch, shooting, whatever else. And I know Kobe Bryant gets a lot of credit in this area. And Evan, I want you to tell me if you think that this is hyperbole in comparison to what other people, like old guys like me around the league, would say. Anthony Edwards is the closest that I've seen in 30 years to a guy that just simply has a drive and nastiness about him of, when I step on that floor, I hate everyone that stands between me and winning.
Are you talking about the guy from Chicago, number 23?
Yes. Honestly, that is, and I know that that's like an absurd comparison to make, because there is nobody that's on the level of Jordan in terms of, like, that creating in his mind rivalries. But Anthony Edwards, to me, just has a competitive nature about him.
There's a cold-blooded killer badge.
I saw it here where I'm like, that guy will push his own mother out of the way if she's standing between him and where he wants to be as a basketball player. I think he is worth double the price of admission every time out. Now, Evan, is that hyperbole?
Honestly, Jake, I don't think you're off there, because there's been a lot of people in the league, a lot of national voices been saying the same thing over the last month or so, where, at least mannerism-wise, when I didn't have the chance, unfortunately, to watch peak Michael Jordan. So LeBron James is kind of my era as far as the greatest player of all time. But you go back and watch Jordan, his peak highlights, you go back and watch Anthony Edwards, the mannerisms are there as far as the athleticism, the way they move on the court, their passion, their defense level, intensity on both ends of the court as well. And you realize Anthony Edwards is nowhere close to his prime either. I mean, this is a guy to me that's going to be a 30-plus, 35-plus point-per-game scorer and potentially be an all-defense kind of player on that other end, too, where I think a lot of executives, a lot of people in the media have been saying the same thing, that Anthony Edwards is probably the closest that we've seen to Michael Jordan as far as drive, athleticism. I think you're not really far off there at all, Jake. I think Anthony Edwards is kind of getting that mantle here as far as the next guy up. And if Minnesota keeps going to run this postseason, that's only going to get louder.
I mean, no question about it. Evan, I know it's a busy time of year for you, so we appreciate it, and we're going to hook you in. If it's Pacers and Knicks, we're going to have you on at some point during that series.
Absolutely, anytime. Appreciate it, guys.
All right, Evan Sidery again from, amongst others, Sporting News, Athlon, Forbes, covering the NBA, and a guy that is from this area, went out to Phoenix, covered the Suns for a while, and I think is very impressive in the way that he has created his own course here in covering the association as well as anybody.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
You know, before we get to talking about the draft and what the Colts did, Mike Chappell joins us from Fox 59 and CBS 4, and I think probably has a story similar to that I just shared. Chap, I was just mentioning that I was in Birmingham over the weekend, and I went to Bessemer, Alabama, which is the hometown of Bo Jackson, amongst many other athletes, but Bo Jackson being the most prominent. And going back to see Bo Jackson's childhood home, you know, for a split second there, I thought maybe I'd made a bad decision. And then once the folks, you know, that live in the area where he grew up realized that I was there because I had an interest in Bo Jackson and a respect for him, they were totally cool. And you know, they were fine with it and it was cool. You told me a similar story. Didn't you go and shadow Edgerrin James and have a similar experience where, because you were showing an interest in Edge and his roots, people were pretty open and welcoming to you?
Oh, no question. Now, did you go knock on the door?
I did not go knock on the door.
I didn't know how forward you are on your, hey, can you show me, you know, what, no, okay. But.
Very. Now, I did have, I went to the La Bianca home where the Manson murders were, and the lady there, once she found out that I was there and was talking to me about it, then invited me into her house to help move furniture. So pretty forward.
Wow.
True story.
Well, Craig Kelly, longtime Colts PR guy, did a lot of that on when they used to do the advanced trips to games, which they don't really do anymore. And he mentioned that one time in, was it Milwaukee when the Colts played up there, that he visited he went by the home of Jeffrey Dahmer. So, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever. But no, with Edgar,
been there many
I went
a time.
There when he was, what's that?
I've been there many a time.
But with Edgerton in, I think it was 01 when he was rehabbing his knee, I went down there and spent a couple of days, me and I think it was Bob Shearer, the old tag with the star. And yeah, I tell you, once you're in Edge's entourage, people really are friendly there. And that's how they are down there anyway. They just open up and, you know, you go to his fun house and you go. It was really kind of amazing, but it is kind of cool to see, in that situation. I went to Marvin Harrison's in Philly once to the old detail shop, which you can read into that what you want. We sat there for the afternoon and all that. But, yeah, it's kind of cool when you get a chance to see where some of all this sort of began.
Totally.
For these guys.
It's fascinating, right? I mean, it's fascinating. Yeah. Mike, what did you think overall? And I know that it's impossible to say with the draft, like, well, this player is – we never know who's going to be great and who's not. I mean, we can get an idea. To me, the bigger assessment when it comes to evaluating a draft is whether or not you felt that the Colts or any franchise addressed the right areas. Did you like the way that they approach things?
Well, we need to learn to – and it's been 8 years now. We need to learn to really take Chris Bauer at his word. He told us how much he liked his cornerback room, how young they are and they're going to grow. And he showed that in the draft with not adding anybody until what round, gosh, what was it, 5 or 6 with Jalen Simpson, who's a cornerback slash safety. And then he got Mike Abraham. So, yeah, I would like to have seen a really dynamic receiver. And that's not the – I'm not piling on, you know, Adonai Mitchell. I'm not, because he was already revved up for that. But and they made attempts. They you know, he told us they made a serious. There were serious discussions on moving up in round one, whether that was for Adunze or whether it was for Malik Neighbors. I don't know, but it showed you that they wanted to do that. It just didn't work out. To me, this draft, a lot of drafts, it's going to depend on is. Latu the right guy. If the first round draft pick does what that guy needs to do and be 10, 12 sacks, you know, at worst, if you get a much, much better pass rush, they were okay last year with 51, you know, and all that, which I never really got the impression they were elite as a pass rushing group, but they got the numbers. But if you get a better pass rush, then your corners don't have to be quite that level. So if this guy can step in and be a difference maker with, you know, Dio and Quitty and all the and DeForest and all those guys, then it's a good draft. And if not, if he doesn't pan out for whatever reason, then you're going to be, you know, swimming upstream. It's so much like Richardson last year. If Richardson's the right guy, then nothing else, you know, everything else matters, but not nearly as much. Because if you miss on the first round guy, especially quarterback, it's not going to work.
The Dean, Mike Chappell of Fox 59 and CBS 4 is our guest. Look, Chap, I've been as plain as anybody, so is Jake, but I've made it clear my feelings about Chris Ballard as a general manager and if I trust him in this era building around Anthony Richardson. Ultimately, it doesn't matter what I think when you look at, you know, it's all about ownership and what they think. Clearly, they believe in him. He has that stamp of approval. You mentioned taking him at his word, him saying a week or two ago how confident he was in that cornerback room. I'm not saying that this is what Jim Irsay is going to feel. I don't even know if, as a whole, Colts ownership would consider things this way. But I'm not mad about the fact they couldn't trade up. I like the idea that if you would have asked any general manager, if they could have a pick of best defensive player in the entire draft, right, you can go any direction you want when it's your clock because no defensive players off the board, they would sign up for that 10 times out of 10. But with the level of confidence, borderline arrogance on that quarterback room, and the investment on Leetu Latu, who I think could be a very, very good player. Like I like all the tape you mentioned about that game against USC. He has proven numbers the last two seasons. I like all of that. But if the cornerback room falters this year, and you had opportunities to fix it in the draft, and let's say they don't go get a veteran late in free agency, where do you assess that in terms of roster construction, roster building, and how much of that goes on Ballard?
Well, it'd be a failure. It'd be like, you know, maybe a couple other years where, you know, he was ripping himself for not doing enough at tackle. And one year it was receiver because injuries hit. And there's no question. If these returning corners outside of Kenny Moore are extremely young and overall unproven, they just are. You know, Juju Brents just didn't play a lot. He didn't hardly practice and didn't play a lot. Jalen Jones, you know, went through some tough stretches, but he got better. But everyone else is just like, well, we think this guy can be pretty good. Dallas Flowers coming back from the Achilles. So, no, there's no question that if everybody else is, well, you know, you get a good pass rush, you're still getting beat deep on all this because of the cornerback. There's no question it falls back on Ballard and his personnel guys, primarily Ballard. So, but we'll see. I still wish they'd sign a veteran corner. I really hope they sign a veteran safety, which I think they will. There's a lot of guys out there, and this time of offseason, it's not going to cost you, you know, super money in the grand scheme of things. I think they still need a proven backup running back, better than Ezekiel Elliott that Dallas got. I mean, is Edgerton still have some years in him? I don't know. but no, that's the whole thing. And also this draft, although, again, getting AD in round two, and this kid's got a chip on his shoulder. He really does. He could have gone off like Ballard did. On the criticism, but I think it also shows the internal belief. I think Reggie's a firm believer in Alec Pierce. I do. I think Reg believes that they could have utilized Pierce better last year. You know, take some shots for crying out loud when he was open. So it does to me reflect a confidence in players stepping up this year. Again, Pierce and people, like, you know, Downs should be better. He's had a Colts rookie record with receptions, and you saw, you know, occasional and frequent brilliance from this kid. So, and again, they're expecting Richardson and Jonathan Taylor, that pairing to kind of lift everyone around him. So, but no, there's no question. If it doesn't work, then the moves you made, it didn't work. And that's we won't know that until like November, when, you know, then it's too late to do much right about it.
Chap, a couple of years ago, I went into, you know, I like watches, right? I've got a handful of wristwatches, and I went into a store, and there was a wristwatch in there that was one that I've always kind of wanted, and it was just an unbelievable price, and I thought, okay, this is like a sign that I'm supposed to get this wristwatch. I don't need another wristwatch per se, but it's nicer than the ones I have, and it just came at a value. So let's say that I had bought, I ended up not buying it, but had I bought it, is that what the Colts did in round one? Was this something, did they go into it expecting to and hoping that this wristwatch was in fact available, or was it one that they very least did not, I mean, they didn't even expect it? But the value of it was right there, even though they've got a couple of decent wristwatches. They knew it was an upgrade, and they couldn't pass it up.
Well, I don't think anyone expected 14 offensive players to come off the board before the Colts, you know, were on the clock. And again, like you guys mentioned, anybody in the draft, did you say, okay, except for the Bears, obviously at one, you will have the pick of the best defensive player. What do you think? They'd say, sign me up. Now, whether it would have been Latu or Dallas Turner or Jared Verse or one of the corners, I don't know. You don't probably think a corner quite that high. But you can, you know, it's the old thing. You can never have enough guys who can rush the passer. And we've talked about this, probably talked about it with you, is he really tipped his hand, did Ballard, when they made their really strong push to sign Daniel Hunter. This franchise had a indie record 51 sacks last year, yet they were in pursuit of one of the top free agents at, you know, in the $48, $50 million range. You know, and then it goes to Houston, but it just showed you that, we were pretty good there, but we need – they just haven't had that guy. You know, maybe the closest is Justin Houston that one year, maybe. But you know, since the Freddie Mathis era, they just haven't had a guy that really keeps coordinators up at night. And now Latu will have to prove he's that guy. But to have a guy that is the catalyst, and they've always talked about, well, it's not so bad to have pass rush by committee, kind of like running back by committee. Well, normally you do that because you don't have the guy. You know, it's not that they don't want it. Gus Bradley would love to have, T.J. Watt or someone like that, but you don't. So then you do it by collection. But this guy has the possibility, the capabilities of being much, much more. And I've not checked Twitter or got a call back yet, but they've got to make a decision on Quiddy Pay now. I asked Ballard about that during the draft. I think they had to pick up his first round option or his fifth round option this week, about $13 million plus for 2025. And does Latu change your approach, or can you not have too many guys that can do that? And 13.4 is a pretty good price, but it's to me, it's not exorbitant to bring Quiddy Pay back. And at the same time, Dio is going to be a free agent after this season. So it's a very, very deep room, but they've got decisions to make coming up on a couple of these guys.
Didn't Ballard basically say in your question, Mike Chappell's our guest, and I know you're the one that asked it about Quiddy Pay, and I'm paraphrasing here, Chap, but didn't Ballard, and to your point, he is usually pretty honest. Like, after the fact, you can look back and you go, he kind of did tell us. Didn't he basically say, like, hey, listen, guys, Quiddy's a good player, and we'd like to retain our own? In other words, maybe Quiddy Pay isn't the lockdown 10-year defensive end bookshelf starter that you thought he was going to be, but he's a nice piece that they'd like to keep a hold of.
I think what you're saying is correct. He said, well, we'll talk about that next week. They know what they're going to do. Maybe they didn't know before they got the pass rusher at 15, but they've had a very long talk. You don't get rid of good players. And like I said, 13.4, it could have been a lot more if he had hit certain triggers on playing time and all that. I don't think that's an over-the-top price for maybe your number two pass rusher next year in 2025. So, yeah, but he says that a lot, though. We like to re-sign their own because, they do. I did note that, and whether that was a tell, I don't know. But again, I think they've got to make a decision. I don't know how they can afford both Quiddy and Dio. And we've always compared at Fox 59 with Dave Griffiths and our guys that I've always compared Quiddy to Jabal Sherrod. And that, I don't mean that negatively. I think Jabal was a great free agent pickup, solid end. Maybe better all around than just a pass rush who's great against a run. And maybe that's what Quiddy is. And if that's the case, great, great. It's just what's your grunt level on wanting to pay that guy. And, again, they're going to have to pay guys coming up with Ryan Kelly, maybe Braden Smith in a few years. And so you've got to kind of be careful what you Bernard Raimann is going to have to get his money if he's their left tackle. So you're always looking ahead. They'll prove me wrong, but I kind of think Quiddy's back because I think, again, the price isn't over the moon, and he's a pretty good player.
Longtime Colts beat writer Mike Chappell is our guest. Chap, it eventually got done. I made the joke, we had to have a classic trade back somewhere, but they eventually got a weapon for Anthony Richardson and Adonai Mitchell. The way that he is best described by many is a boomer bust playmaker that has the ability to go win contested catches, that can be a red zone weapon, raw for certain, but if you can put everything together, could be a very good receiver in this league. As you look at the Colts depth chart, is it Alec Pierce that winds up being the odd man out with the addition of Mitchell?
Well, that's where you project it, and I'm sure Pierce is going to say, yeah, not so fast, my man. So, but no, there's only so many slots and so many you know, guys you can put out there. But that's what his spot will be, is that deep threat. And right now, Alec Pierce still sort of is primarily a deep threat. They've tried to do some things with him, but, you know, again, I think his development has been stunted by the quarterbacks that they've had. So, no, there's no question. And you know what's really funny, and it's things you really can't write, but AD was really upset about being the 11th receiver taken. And, you know, some places had him, you know, top six, top seven. Well, you know, the Colts traded back to get him. They were at 46, and they traded back to 52, so he could have been peeled at the Colts as well if you want to go that far. But this kid's got a really good upside, and it's what they've been missing, because Pierce was that guy. They just, you know, I bet there were 10, 12, 14 times last year where Pierce is running by himself behind the secondary, and they either couldn't or wouldn't get the ball to him. You know, add six or seven deep balls to Alec Pierce's game last year, and no one's really complaining about what he did. So that's why I say I think we undervalue Pierce going forward a lot more than the Colts do. I think they think, and I know Reggie does. Reggie's a big believer, and I think Reggie's a big believer in the guys they got. You know, the Anthony Gold guy is going to be primarily, I think, initially a punt kick return guy, but he's shown ability to play maybe out of the slot if Downs gets dinged up or whatever. So, yeah, we'll see how this goes. But, again, I just think this draft shows that they had more confidence in guys coming back than what we did with the way they handled the draft. But, you know, people who put grades on the draft, I used to do that all the time, and I hated it. You know, you grade the draft in like 2 years. So, but they addressed some needs. They got probably their center of the future.
I was just going to ask that, Mike. You know, I think you're one that has said that you've talked to Ryan Kelly about maybe Kelly is starting to, even though some of us like thought, well, this is it for him, you know, 2 years ago or whatever.
Right.
Ryan Kelly has a pretty clear timeline, I think, a more realistic one about how long he thinks, you know, he wants to play. And it does seem as though, and you know, one of the greatest centers of all time, Mike Webster, was a center out of Wisconsin. I'm not saying that that's what Indy gets now, and Tanner Bordellini, if I'm saying that correct. But is it possible this is a guy that it's like where the timing works out perfectly, and they're like, look, we'll kind of let him groom under Kelly, and then, you know, you kind of hand the keys over.
Yeah, I mean, he'll be like one of their, if he can develop quickly, he'll be one of their top interior backups, left guard, which Quentin never doesn't play. I hate double negatives, but that's, and then Kelly has missed some time. Concussions are a little bit of a concern. And then, you know, Will Fries, who's going to be a free agent at the end of the season. So there's no question. The third round pick, Gonzalez, no, I'll call him Matt. You know, he'll be a swing tackle for him. So you're always looking ahead. I talked to Kelly, I don't know, about 10 days ago. He was out knocking golf balls at their Ursa's par threes out there. And he said, you know, 10 years has a good ring to it. He's going into ninth year. So maybe they handle Kelly like, if he has another strong year, he turns 31 in May. Maybe they do with him like they did Costanzo. Remember, they Costanzo had played 9 years. They signed him into a two-year deal. And he played the 10th year, then he retired. Maybe Kelly would do that if he's still playing at a high level. You're resigning. You just don't get rid of good players. So, but I think that 10-year figure has a ring to it with Kelly, and he's in good shape. I don't know what kind of golfer he is. He was out, you know, probably picking up more divots than he was anything else. But if Kelly plays well, you just don't get him a Pro Bowl center. You just don't with a young quarterback. And then you've got this guy waiting in the wings. Maybe he re-signed Kelly for next year, for 2025, and you let Bordellini be your right guard if you don't re-sign Will Fryer. So their deepest areas right now are defensive line. They got a slew of people. Good luck making the roster if you're number 8, 9, or 10. And offensive line. They got a lot of players at that spot, and that's what Ballard always says that people sometimes complain about, offensive line, defensive line, you know, build it inside out. And those two areas are extremely well stocked right now.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Mike Chappell is our guest, CBS 4 and Fox 59, of course, where you can read his work. Chap, I guess last question for you here would be this. There is always a player, for the most part, for the Colts, through the undrafted free agent process that all of a sudden, like, you know, we're going to be sitting out there at Grand Park and go, you know, this guy actually has a chance of making the roster. Who knows which player that's going to be? But a guy that would be at what position that they went through the undrafted free agent process with would stand to be one that has the best shot? Did they seem to target a specific area in that regard?
Well, I would look at what they don't have after the draft and all this. I'd say running back. I think they can get a running back. Linebacker, maybe. Maybe linebacker. Or, again, I would not want an undrafted guy to be a guy that emerges at corner or safety. I think I just think those positions cry out for a veteran free agent if you can. But I could see running back, people say, hey, that guy looks pretty good. Or linebacker, because they've got sort of a thin room a little bit. So those two positions probably. All the other positions are pretty well loaded with guys that have done something thus far.
Chap, how much pressure is being put on Jelani Woods going into next year?
Oh, a lot. And I'm sure he knows. But again, and it was so frustrating last year because he had the one hamstring during training camp, and he's getting back from that, and then he messes up the other one. So, no question. Well, since we're in the tight end room, then Drew Ogletree. I mean, those two guys, I mean, for different reasons, but they've both shown you things with their size and what they can do. And for different reasons, they haven't been able to do it. And for greatly different reasons. So those two guys, because boy, we've seen what they can do, and maybe a Shane Steichen offense where, you know, maybe they had an interest in Brock Bowers, I don't know. But one of those guys has a chance to really emerge in a diverse tight end room. But, you know, are they both here? Probably. But the fact that they didn't cut ties with Drew Ogletree after he was taken off the commissioner's list tells you that they think this guy's got a chance to play. And they were okay with – and they were more than okay with how the investigation and their background worked in on the situation.
Chap, you ever been to Birmingham, Alabama?
No, I went to Jackson, Mississippi, which is not hardly –
I was there for the Colts and Saints, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, if you're going to go to Birmingham, first off,
I went to cover IU's game at the with Bill Mallory against Florida State and
Sammy Smith ran All-American Bowl. Smith ran all over him, man.
Yeah, you remember that better than I do. I just
86.
Remember Bill Mallory and all. Yes, 86 is like three lifetimes ago for me.
Well, let me tell you, if you're going to go to Birmingham, two things. If you're going to go by Bessemer to see Bo Jackson's childhood home, I would call first, just so you know. And then secondly, if you go inside the Barber, I thought of you yesterday because I was at the Barber Motorsports Park Museum, which is right there on the grounds where IndyCar is, and it's an unbelievable automotive museum of collection. And around the corner, and there's this gorgeous, I mean, beautiful car that is painted in kind of like, I don't know, like paisley-type coloring. And I'm like, now, what is this? And it was the car that, it's a Bentley, and it's the Bentley that contractually the Beatles had signed to transport them when they first came to the United States and did their tour that included going by the Ed Sullivan Theater in their Bentley.
And
it's that car, and it's like in pristine shape, and it was pretty cool.
It's funny you mentioned Bo Jackson, and I've talked to Dwight Freeney quite a bit since the Hall of Fame and all that stuff, and he said growing up he wanted to be Bo Jackson. He wanted to be great, like in football. He wanted to be great in baseball. So it's really Bo Jackson, had it not been for the hip, my goodness, what a player.
Listen, he is the greatest athlete of my, like, coming of age. You know what I mean? Because, yeah. I mean, everybody has that athlete that they probably romanticize in their mind, chat, because they saw them play, like started watching them when they were 15 and then until they were 22 or whatever. Bo Jackson's window was so short, right? But I mean,
almost a dislocated hip or something.
Correct. It happened actually against the Bengals when he in the playoffs. So the Bengals, until Joe Burrow arrived, it was the Bengals' last playoff victory, would have been the week before that, but or in that game maybe it was. But yes, his hip was pulled out of socket.
Right.
And he ended up getting a hip replacement. That ended his NFL career. He got a hip replacement, still came back, and in his first at-bat as a Major League Baseball player with an artificial hip, he hit a home run for the Chicago White Sox.
Unbelievable player. Unbelievable player. Deion Sanders, yeah. Two sports star. Give me Bo. Give me Bo.
I totally agree. Largest, highest yard per carry average in NFL history at the time of his retirement. Pretty darn good.
Phenomenal player. Again, when God made athletes, he said, yeah, you're special. Let's put you like top 10 or whatever all time. And unbelievable.
No doubt about it. Chap, we appreciate the time as always. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you next week.
All right, Mike Chappell.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
One guy who is more important than any of the three on this program, he's the television voice of the Indiana Pacers, of course, on Bally's Television and the Pacers Television Network, if that's such a thing. He works, obviously, with Eddie Gill, Jeremiah Johnson, and is on his way to Milwaukee. So, too, are the Pacers to try to close out the Milwaukee Bucks. Chris Denari joins us on the program. Chris, the, I guess, easy question I'll get to right away, is the knockout blow the hardest to land?
Yeah, I think so, especially when you have to go on the road for Game 5. You've got a nice advantage at 3-1, but to try to get Game 4 on the road is tough, because then if you don't do it, then the pressure is on you to come back for Game 6 and try to get win number 4 at home. So Rick Carlisle said that, you know, yesterday at halftime, he said, you're only halfway through the series. And the Pacers had a 2-1 lead and then had a 3-point lead going into the second half last night. And they did a nice job in winning the second half and winning the game. But I do think that the fourth and final win is always the toughest, and it'll be tough tomorrow night in Milwaukee, no matter who suits up for them.
Chris, what was it like from your seat? Not that he isn't appreciated in sectors of the fan base, but to see Miles Turner get that amount of flowers thrown his way and the exclamation point three that he hits after the Miles Turner chance rained down on him. Well, walk me through that from yours and Quinn's vantage point.
It was pretty special. There's no question. And I've watched some of the things that I saw on X, you know, from the upper level seats where people were, you know, had their cameras on when all that was happening. And then he hit the three, and to see the whole building explode, you know, it was loud. It was raucous. And I said this to JMB the other night, and hopefully he has quite a while to play. But I truly believe that when it's all said and done, and how many ever years it is from now, I believe that Miles Turner will be one of the most beloved Pacers in the history of the franchise because of what he's gone through, what he has accomplished thus far. And again, he's in his ninth year, and hopefully there are many more years to come. But there is nobody else, you know, that I think that has embodied this franchise, you know, any better recently than Miles. Of course, Reggie, for 18 years, what he did. I mean, there are a lot of players that have embodied what Pacers basketball is all about. But as I look at recent times and the longevity that Miles has had and the love he has for the city, what he's done off the floor, what he's done on the floor, I truly believe he will be one of the most beloved Pacer. But I firmly believe there's a whole lot more for him to accomplish, and to see what he's done to start this playoffs has been simply special.
Chris, I think one of the things about Indiana to me that is the most satisfying is that this is a franchise that with this particular group, and I know the Siakam acquisition is a huge, huge piece, don't get me wrong, but they never really panicked and went out. They knew the timeline was going to be 2 to 3 years. They might even be ahead of that a little bit, but they've just kind of accumulated this with a vision and then piece by piece. You know, from Neesmith giving him an opportunity and seeing that blossom to Nembhard to, you know, it's Ben Shepherd is playing well. Is, as they progress here, are they going to fall victim to what other teams do of getting too aggressive and too greedy and then turning some of those pieces into what they think is going to be a big upgrade a la a Bradley Beal in Phoenix?
I don't think so. I don't think so, Jake. I just don't think that's the way that this franchise has operated. And I think they understand you build it organically, but when you have a chance to strike, as they did with the trade for Tyrese Haliburton and recently the trade for Pascal Siakam, you go out and get it done. And, you know, honest, to get Haliburton, you had to give up a really good player in Sabonis, a multi-time All-Star. And we know what he's done in Sacramento, but it also freed up what Miles Turner can do for you, what Tyrese Haliburton has unlocked, if you will. And then, you know, quite honestly, I mean, some would argue that, okay, you had to give up Bruce Brown and a couple of first-round draft picks to get Pascal Siakam, but in my eyes, that was a really good deal because this year's draft is not supposed to be very strong. And while I like Bruce Brown, we've already seen what Pascal Siakam means to this team and what he can do in the playoffs. So I don't think so. I think you were there a couple of years ago, Jake, when you know Kevin Pritchard met with the media and said, look, this is a process, and we're going to take it step by step. And I think they've done that. But I think when they saw there was an opportunity to get somebody like Pascal Siakam, they could speed up the process a little bit without going overboard. And I think they have the perfect mix of veterans and young talent on this team, and hopefully they're going to be a team that is contending for Eastern Conference championships over the next number of years.
Chris Denari is our guest, TV voice of the Indiana Pacers. You can find him and Quinn Buckner along with Pat Boyle and Eddie Gill and company when the series shifts back to Milwaukee on Tuesday night with that game still being on Bally Sports. Chris, I'll poise this to you like Jake did to both of us earlier in the show as a, along with Jake, fellow voice of the Indy 500. On the one hand, I was jealous I could not acquire one. I was late on the draw, but the Pacers Racers shirts that they had as the game night special last night were very, very cool. I'm looking forward to seeing those out and about over the next couple of days in the coming weeks. But does the next series, since Game 6 or Game 7, could be, quote, close to that stretch run in the countdown to the 500, does next series count as Pacers, Racers level of play, or is that exclusively reserved for the holy ground of conference finals crossing over with that last home stretch, the big race?
Well, the biggest change has been out at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. There's now a road course race early in the month, and if you think back, you know, a number of years ago, that race did not exist. So I believe if there are cars on track and there are Pacers playing at Gainbridge Fieldhouse, whatever that is, I believe that qualifies as Racers and Pacers. So, you know, I'm just hopeful that the Pacers get there. I mean, there's still work to be done. I know they have a 3-1 lead and are in the driver's seat. But you've got to make sure you get the fourth and final win of this series.
Yeah, not trying to put the cart before the horse fully. I don't know when the next time we'll talk to you is. So just on the off chance, I just wanted you to be able to weigh in there.
Yeah. So, no, I believe if there are cars on track, and there will definitely be cars on track late next week, right, ahead of the Saturday race, and there is Pacers playoff basketball going on, I think that qualifies for Racers and Pacers, or Pacers and Racers, however you want to call it.
Chris, I heard you mention Chris Denari, the television voice of the Indiana Pacers, is our guest. You, I think it was with John, you had shared that a player, maybe Eddie Gill, had told you that they always felt like a team coming off a loss has an advantage in a playoff series because then they're the ones that kind of make the adjustment or make the move on the chessboard. Do you anticipate that Milwaukee does do that at this point, and or have we reached a point in the series where both teams pretty much have shown every hand they could have?
I don't think probably everybody's shown every hand that they have. I'm sure Doc Rivers has something up his sleeve to try to turn the tables, and we don't know what the availability of Giannis and Damian Lillard are. They were not ruled out for the series. They were ruled out for game four. It'll be interesting once that initial injury report comes out. If they're both listed as doubtful, then I would highly doubt that they play on Tuesday night, but we'll just have to wait and see. I would say there is still more to come, probably on both ends with adjustments. And I think you have to give the Pacers a lot of credit because to that point, they lost game one and won game two. And then if that is true, Milwaukee would have had the advantage going into game three. Pacers held serve and won. And then Milwaukee would have had the advantage having lost game three going into game four, and the Pacers were able to get that win as well. So I think Indiana's done a really good job of doing whatever they needed to do to get the win at the time of that game, and we'll have to see how that unfolds with game five.
Chris, the obvious answer here is Miles Turner, okay? And Halliburton has been able to facilitate really well, and obviously offensively has been dynamic here the last two games. But who jumps out at you, aside from those two, as the guy that's been the most consistent performer games one through four so far for Indiana?
I would say, Siakam's been consistent from the standpoint. He hadn't had 230-point games the last two games like he had in one and two. I would say in games two through four, it's been Andrew Nembhard. He did not have a great game one, but I think that was him getting acclimated to what the playoffs are all about. I think Obi Toppin's been really strong off the bench. McConnell, I think that's the great strength of this Pacers team, Jake, is that they've got a lot of dependable and reliable players. I mean, look at it last night. Your NBA leading assist man did not lead the team in assists last night. He wasn't even second, and he wasn't even third. Now, he had 24 points. But you had Andrew Nembhard with 9 assists, T.J. McConnell with 8, and Pascal Siakam with 7. I think that says a lot about what this Pacers basketball team is all about. And when those numbers are like that, they are tough to beat.
When Nembhard was selected second overall, Chris, in the second round, I mean, when Nembhard was selected as a second round pick and then immediately signed is what I was going to get to the fact that, you know, he got this big contract for a second rounder, and I think people kind of like raise their eyebrows to it a little bit. But he seems to have kind of this mentality that's never escaped him of, I'm not the guy that gets the headlines. I'm not the guy that was the lottery pick, but here I am and I'm not going away. How much of his journey has benefited him in terms of just the toughness that he plays with that is his calling card in this series?
Yeah, I mean, he is tough. When you get in between those 94 by 50 lines, I mean, you don't want to mess with him. I mean, he was not going to back down to Bobby Portis last night. He's very soft-spoken. He's very polite. He's a wonderful person to be around. And he played at a very high level. I mean, think about it. He was with Gonzaga when they had a chance to go undefeated and win a national championship at Lucas Oil Stadium. They came up short and lost to Baylor. He's played at a high level in college. He's very confident. And as he told me the other day, I interviewed him for Pacers Weekly last Saturday, and I said, there's so much focus on Halliburton, Siakam, and Turner. Sometimes in the starting lineup, Nembhard and Nesmith get lost, I guess, offensively, at least as maybe the scouting report is said. He said, look, he goes, we play a random style of basketball. We move, we play for each other, so there are opportunities that we can take advantage of that maybe guys in my spot on other teams wouldn't. And, he started over 100 games in his career, and as you said, Jake, he's a second-round draft pick. And I think the Pacers knew when they got him that they wanted to make sure they locked him up for a number of years. And you just don't see second-round draft picks get guaranteed money like Andrew Nembhard got 2 years ago. And now we're seeing why the Pacers wanted to do that.
Chris, Michael and Luke from Australia are going to be up in Game 5. They told me they're going to wear their Pacers shirts. Michael's worried he's going to get in a fight in Milwaukee because he thinks the fans there are going to get after him because the Pacers are going to win. So I told him not to worry. You're going to be there. You'll have us back. Cool?
I will be there to protect him. You know, he texted me last night when it came out that Tyrese was questionable with back spasms. He was beside himself because remember when he went out west for that long road trip, Tyrese was out a little bit, and he said, right. Am I bad luck or something? And I said, no, Michael, you're not bad luck. He's in the starting lineup. It is so great to see him and see the passion that he has for Pacers basketball from down under, and I'm glad he's getting to experience this.
And he's one of many. I mean, you know, look, it just so happens we know him, but there are a lot of fans from, you know, Australia and Asia that come over to see the Pacers, and we'll see if they can get it done. Again, game number 5 tomorrow night in Milwaukee, 9:30 tip. Chris, get your coffee, okay?
I'll have plenty of that tomorrow, I can assure you.
That seemed like an almost angry Chris Denari there. Wow, I've never heard it that way, right?
Well there's a coffee shop about 2 blocks away that I'll probably be there in the morning, the afternoon, and I may even stop by there before I get on the bus to go to Fiserv Forum.
Well,
I may be there 3 times tomorrow.
If you go in December like Shannon and I do, it gets dark there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so you can go ahead and drink an entire pot of coffee by 7:30 just to get through the night. Chris, travel safely, and we will be watching, all right?
All right, thanks, Jake. Thanks,
all right.
Jimmy.
Chris Denari, the television voice of the Indiana Pacers.